welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. We are broadcasting live from the Mobile Kintech studio on site here at Andrew Sherritt in Richmond. More on that in just a second. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host, of course, is Thomas Drance. He covers the team at The Athletic as well. Before we get in to the meat of the show, and with the draft just a day away, deals are happening, reports are out there, there's a lot to get into, but of course I got to tell you about the big event today happening at Andrew Sherritt in Richmond. Fantastic event. We're here pretty much every summer at a different Andrew Sherritt location, and it's always a great event featuring Milwaukee tools. You can come down, you can test some of Milwaukee's latest gear, see some live demos, explore cutting edge tool tech. There's very special, exclusive, one-day-only deals, special offers. Plus, the Say Cheese food truck is here. The Say Cheese grilled cheese food truck is here. Drance and I both sampled it before the show. Fantastic. And hey, if you spend $50 or more, you get a free grilled cheese from the Say Cheese food truck. So that's very, very exciting. I will also say there's some very sharp, it's a collab, as the kids say, some sharp Milwaukee Andrew Sherritt collab hats that are up for grabs. I tried to get one.
Yeah, they're
I was
very
told
cool.
They're for paying customers only. Go away. And I said, all right, that's fair. But I believe if I forget exactly what the spend was, but the first 100 customers, I believe.
And then they offered you another bag of chips.
Yeah, that's right. Go have a Dr. Pepper, buddy.
Two things. First of all, I grabbed a thing of Sweet Chili Heat and showed it to you, pointing at the bag like, this is the king of chips.
Yes.
And you like rolled your eyes at me. You were like, whatever, man. Who cares? And then the other thing is you grabbed your grilled cheese from the cheese truck and walked away. And I was like, no ketchup? And looked at you like you were a wild man. And you hit me with a, no, I'm an adult. Which I felt like is my line.
Look, the grilled cheese stood on its own. It didn't need the ketchup. It was delicious. I had the three cheese with the sourdough bread. It was absolutely sensational. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And again, if you're out and about, this really is a fantastic event. Every year we do this, people come by and they're thrilled that they heard about it and they came by and saw the deals and picked up a new tool. Whatever you need, there's a really impressive display here of Milwaukee stuff. So come on by. Enjoy the food truck. Check out the deals. Maybe get yourself a sweet hat. Come say hi if you're in the Richmond area. Again, it's the Andrew Sherritt in Richmond. One day only special event with Milwaukee with some fantastic tools and deals to be had. So we will update you on that status throughout the course of the day. And coming up on the show, we're going to hear from the newest member of the Vancouver Canucks. Evander Kane will speak to the media at 1 o'clock. We will carry that live on the station. I think it's fair to say that there's probably, you know, we always love to hear from the newly acquired Canucks or if somebody signs an extension. I think it's fair to say there's probably a greater degree of interest in this one in particular, given Evander Kane as a local product, of course, and also just some of the reaction that we saw yesterday. Some of the questions, some of the natural questions that you would expect will be asked today.
A polarized reaction, I'd say, in the market.
Yes, very much so. So we'll be curious to hear from that. And then Jason Buchla will join us at 1:30. And always excited to chat with Books. And especially,
I don't think he's a big fan of the trade, so fair warning to our audience.
So he is one of the many polarized people on this trade.
Yes.
That makes sense.
I don't think, now, you know, I do a lot of thinking. And I think you know that about me, Jamie.
Yes, yes.
And I've been thinking a little bit more about this trade and especially some of the reporting that's come out, sort of building on something that I've been talking about since late last week, the idea that the Canucks really do want to prioritize signing Thatcher Demko and getting an extension done. That, you know, I've thought that that was the most likely outcome for them for about 10 days now. But based on Rick Dhaliwal's reporting, some reporting from Darren Dreger, you know, it really does feel like that's beginning to gather momentum as a storyline. Although, you know, I'd suggest not getting too far ahead, like from, you know, what I understand, like the Canucks want to do it, but I hadn't heard momentum yesterday.
Sure.
Like, you know, to the extent of the club expects it to be done July 1 or something like that.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I hadn't heard that. I know some of the reporting has gone so far as to suggest that it's really trending in that direction. That's not my intel, although I don't doubt what's being reported by other high-quality information providers in the marketplace. And I've been thinking about the Kane deal and the Demko news sort of in concert, because I actually think there's a through line there. And it's one that I'm sort of skeptical of, generally speaking, and I think is the main reason why, you know, for me anyway, I'm not that high, or at least I'm skeptical about the impact of a Kane acquisition for this team at this moment, right? And a lot of the discussion in the wake of the trade focused on one of two things. Either it's a buy low on this, you know, power forward type rare profile, or it's a huge risk to take in terms of the cultural fit in a already volatile locker room situation. And we can parcel those things out further. But just from a hockey perspective, and I tried to talk about this with Donnie and Dolly a little bit, but I don't know if I quite got the point across.
It didn't penetrate.
Yeah.
You don't say.
And, but, you know, there's an opportunity cost to making this trade, right? It's not a fourth round pick necessarily. It's a fourth round pick and one of your major bullets that you can use to bring in players, right? Because it's a $5 million commitment. And that's $5 million less cap space. If the Canucks are to sort of land the top six center of their dreams across the next 36 hours, they're going to have to send another player out, right? So there's hidden costs beyond the acquisition cost to this deal. And likewise, I think in the event that the Canucks decide to extend Demko, there are hidden costs there too. And in particular, you know, one of them is the return he could fetch on the market right now, a market that's basically devoid of goaltending quality. The second part of it is the $5 million in cap space that you'd free up, especially if you're willing to ride with Demko and Lankinen, right? So that gets you, like, an additional bullet. And so you sort of put the Demko and Evander Kane deals together, right? And it's like, that's actually a fair bit of opportunity cost or value lost between the assets that you could get, the assets that you paid for Kane, and the cap space that both would represent on, you know, a pair of moves that I think are like fundamentally a little bit low floor, right? And this is what I mean
low
by
low floor
that.
Or low ceiling?
Sorry, low ceiling.
Yeah.
Low ceiling. I mean, I would argue that they're probably low floor too, just given Kane's age and Demko's
well, the injury
recent
between both of them, absolutely.
Right, right. Both of them have – so I would say they're both low floor and low ceiling, which I don't love, Jamie, I'm not going to lie. And I think the through line, like the vision that unnerves me, that I'm skeptical of, frankly, is this idea that, like, the value that Kane provides is he makes your top six tougher to play against, heavier, right? Heavier, bigger, more battle-tested in the toughest games of the year. And that's sort of where I think we should have the most confidence in Kane, is it's like, we know this guy has the stomach for the fight when the fight gets toughest at the pointy end of the season. And I, you know, much respect to him for that, because that matters a ton. And the main value that Demko provides is he gives you this high-end goaltending tandem where if you're the Canucks, you can go into next season and say, hey, we are as good a bet as anybody to have the best goaltending in the league. And you put it together, and I just worry that, like, when do those two things matter most if you're trying to tell yourself a story about where this team can go?
The playoffs, yeah.
Right? And so it just, like, do these moves limit this team's ability to conduct themselves with a higher degree of ambition and attempt to build a great team? And instead, is it evidence of a club that's preparing to settle for trying to engineer, like, the Bergevin-era Montreal Canadiens?
Almost like you're consciously building a Cinderella team.
Right.
You're consciously building a team that can be a 7th or 8th seed, maybe, but win a couple rounds and get hot and go on a run. Behind, you know, some playoff savvy and physicality and a goaltender who we know can go...
And an elite defender.
Can have elite stretches of hockey in it.
Right. Well, yeah, right. That's Thatcher Demko's 6 to 8 week runs that he puts together sometime where he is completely dominant, you know, I think have shaped perception around him. And we've said it for a long time. If you could ever get that in May and June, like, oh boy, right? That would be amazing. So engineering that with another highly paid goaltender and really limiting his starts in the regular season and hoping that you get the most dominant version of Demko in the playoffs. Like, that's an angle that I'm actually quite interested in, assuming that the price of his extension is relatively reasonable and that, you know, he's able to put the injury behind him and perform at the level that he did prior to it. So, yeah, I think as I'm sort of trying to draw a through line to the information that I've been reporting from what I've been hearing and just trying to understand where the Canucks are at without getting pre-mad,
yes.
without getting pre-mad,
yes.
Jamie,
yes.
I sort of land in this place where I get a little bit concerned that this is an exercise in trying to middle it, in trying to build a team that's imposing in the spring and, you know, a coin flip about as to whether or not they have the juice to actually get there in the first place. I just think that's a really uncomfortable place to be in. And I feel like your chances of succeeding in the contemporary NHL, where, you know, it's a shooter's league, goalies aren't stealing playoff series, they're rarely stealing games anymore, and where the calcification between, like, where the gap between the middle-run teams and the real contenders has grown, in my estimation, right? It's not like we're seeing a different pair of cup finalists every year, or different teams in the conference final, or, like, real Cinderella runs. I mean, we had the Canadiens during that bizarre season.
Yeah.
But I mean, for the most part, you know, in the West, at the pointy end of the Western Conference playoff bracket, it's going to be Dallas, it's going to be Colorado, it's going to be Vegas, it's going to be Edmonton, and no one else has really been there in a long time. And likewise in the East, it's going to be Carolina, it's going to be New York. They might not be back there for a bit. And it's going to be one of the teams from Florida. And no one else has really been able to puncture that arithmetic either, and so I just worry that the Canucks are making a low ceiling bet out of time, and that Kane kind of represents almost like a loss of ambition as this club tries to sort of get back on track in a more superficial way, as opposed to getting back on track with a bigger vision for how to deliver a Stanley Cup to Vancouver.
And I do wonder, because I think you're onto something there about, like, okay, how we're probably not going to be able to build a team that competes for 82 games with Edmonton and Vegas and Dallas in the Western Conference, and you want to throw Florida and the Eastern Conference teams in there as well. How much of what you're describing is like a philosophical preference, and how much of it is a pivot once the realities of this market kind of confronted the team? Because, again, I think if you piece together those moves, right, betting on Demko, bringing in a player like Evander Kane, who's coming off, you know, a series of pretty successful and impactful playoff runs with the Edmonton Oilers, it makes sense, as you laid it out. But if you go back and listen to what the messaging was at the end of the regular season, to me it sounded much more like, we want to be aggressive to try to become an elite team. Not the kind of this path, this pivot path that you're laying out. So I do wonder how much of it is kind of a philosophical desire to go down this path, and how much of it was, well, the other way is not going to be possible, so we're going to try this as the best of a bunch of bad alternatives or less attractive alternatives that exist towards us. And I want to talk about some of the other stuff happening around the NHL, but just on Kane, and we'll hear from Kane later. And, you know, obviously this was a big deal. As you said, a very polarizing reaction, understandably, for a lot of reasons. And I was kind of trying to, and I think we handled it pretty fairly on the show yesterday, but I was trying to take some time over the last 24 hours or so to kind of think through it a little bit more. And the more I think about it, I think the whole idea of it being this high risk, high reward bet or trade is kind of wrong. And I'm not going to say there's no risk, because obviously we know about the off-ice elements of what Evander Kane brings, and I can see the risk there. On the other hand, it's a fourth-round pick and it's 1 year.
Well, and just to contextualize this, for me anyway, that side of it, the downside risk of that, is less about Kane to some extent and more about the overall circumstances, where it's like you've got a rookie head coach,
sure,
who didn't make it through his only season being a head coach in the WHL. You've got a center in Elias Pettersson who is embattled, I think it's fair to say, in terms of local perception of where his game is at. The pressure on him is going to be very high to have a bounce back. You've got Quinn Hughes, who, you know, there is an industry perception out there that his future is murky in and around the Canucks. You've got the goaltending tandem. I mean, how much heat is Foot going to take every start-sit-start decision?
Like, dude, remember when there was people clamoring for Spencer Martin to start over Thatcher Demko?
I mean, this is... right, I do. And this is like this is a market that loves its backups. This is a market.
Oh, yeah.
If you're talking about the conversation in Vancouver being constantly, you know, you extend Demko and go into the next season with two highly paid goaltenders, like those debates are going to be endless. It'll be hard for us to discuss anything else.
Yeah.
So it's not as if, you know, you then add Evander Kane into the equation and it's like, man, like there is a fair bit of uncertainty, especially, you know, given the history of how last season went. And, you know, the lengthy history of this core underachieving.
Yeah, the idea of like, oh, Evander Kane's going to come in and he's going to make it a toxic room and it's going to collapse their season. Like, I'm selling on that. Not that it's not impossible, I guess, but or that it is impossible, but I'm selling on that idea. But again, I think like I'm also kind of selling on the idea that it's this massively high upside play too, right? And I get the, oh, he's a rare physical profile and all of that. But you also look at his track record over the last several years, and he's a non-star, non-play-driving winger. And just generally, those are the types of players that don't really move the needle much in either direction for them, right? Like,
right.
I don't know, we just saw Jake DeBrusque come in and score a career high in goals and never really feel like he was dramatically impacting the team. And I don't say that to take a shot at Jake DeBrusque. He had a good season. But he's a non-star, non-play-driving winger. And those guys can have good seasons for you relative to their standards, and it won't move the needle much for your team. And the more I thought about it, I just kind of think, like, if you step back from the fact that it's Evander Kane, and he was always going to have he has an outsized presence in the imagination of this city because he's an East Vancouver, brash power forward who played for the Giants, right? Like, he was all this trade was going to blow up here more than anywhere else, but if you step back from those kind of biographical details and just look at the on-ice element,
he's the true heir to Milan Lucic
yes.
in terms of, like, Vancouver mindshare.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but if you step back from that element of it, it's like,
good, tough Western Canadian kid, baby!
There's a really good chance that he plays 65 to 75 games, scores, like, 18 to 22 goals, and doesn't really move the needle.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's because he's not a play-driving winger, he's not a play-driving player, and he's not really a star player. And so that's what those guys do. And so I think if he does that, you know, if he plays 70 games and scores 20 goals, there's going to be a lot of people saying, like, wow, for a fourth-round pick, that's good business. And they're not necessarily wrong, but the issue I keep coming back to is just the idea of opportunity cost. By committing this cap space, almost half of the cap space they had available, you are implicitly taking yourself out of the running for higher ceiling types of deals. The counter argument to that is, well, they're probably not out there. And so that's fair. But it's just kind of like, I think what I'm getting to is, like, we're going to spend so much time talking about Evander Kane next year, and we already have, and he's very unlikely to be high on the list of either why this team fails or succeeds.
It's not just hockey DB, because there's a more pernicious level. It's called the graph analysis generation.
Sure.
And all
sure.
they do is look at a JFresh graph and be like, well, this is who the player is.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, come on, man. Because it's not just Kesslering. Josh Doan is also nasty. Like, nasty.
Yeah.
Got some of that good Brandon Hagel-type dog in him and is still young and is physical, and I think there could be more offense there if he's not playing, you know, every shift with Lawson Crouse. So, anyway, I look at that deal and actually think Buffalo did okay given the bad situation, and certainly did not accept a package that any team could have easily thrown together if only their general manager wasn't asleep at the wheel. Kesslering, 6'4", 30 points, got pushed up the lineup because of injuries to Marino and Durzi last year, crushed it in a larger role, moved the puck really well, like really strong skater, right-handed $1.4 million contract, RFA on expiry. I mean, couldn't GM trade catnip in the lab more appealing than that. And, like, I genuinely think that for most teams, given how few teams are interested in selling right now, I think for most teams he would have more exchange value than Tom Volander.
Well, and I will also say this about Kesslering. If Kesslering had played his last 2 years in Vancouver, right, and my Wi-Fi is being wonky here, but whatever point production he had as a 6'5" right shot defenseman,
29 points last year.
29 points.
21 the year before.
In like 60 games or something, right?
Without a serious heaping of power.
And we came on and said they should trade that player for J.J. Paterka. People will be like, you're out of your minds. You can't trade a big, physical,
correct,
talented right shot defenseman for a scoring winger who's defensively suspect. And they'd have an argument. They'd have at least an argument to give you pause, right? So do not sleep on the value that that type of player in Kesselring specifically has.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised that he was one of the prime pieces. Well, I think people were waiting for that, like, one other piece for Buffalo. But it's also Buffalo, so there's always just going to be a rush to dunk on them.
Yes.
Because they have not – they've done the opposite of earned the benefit of the doubt.
Just like the McLeod acquisition for Savoy, and people were like, wow, like, Savoy, the Oilers just stole a guy who's going to play in their top six. Like, Savoy's not – Savoy's like 50-50 to be on that team next year, and McLeod had 50 points. Like,
yeah.
That was a wildly misunderstood deal just because Kevin Adams doesn't have cachet in the minds of hockey fans, which, by the way, totally fair.
I get it, too. I absolutely get
it. But you have to take a step back and break these deals down, and I actually thought that Buffalo did pretty well with that deal. I do not think by any means that I do not think that there was an easy answer or a comparable deal that the Canucks could have put together to get into that mix.
Yeah. All right, we will take a break here. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. As a reminder, we're on location at Andrew Sherritt in Richmond for the big Milwaukee event. Come on down. There's the Say Cheese Grilled Cheese food truck. There's incredible deals on Milwaukee Tools. You get to see some live demos, some new tools that you can check out. So get some hands-on time with them as well. So come on down. Say hi. Andrew Sherritt in Richmond. We'll take a break. We'll hear from Evander Kane later and Jason Bukala at 1:30 as well. But we got an open segment up next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, broadcasting live from the Mobile Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And we've got the Wi-Fi situation all fixed up.
Yeah, sorry about that, everybody.
So what happened was the same thing that prevented me from being able to access the inbox was also digitizing our voices such that we sounded like robots, but I couldn't see all the people texting in about that because I couldn't access the inbox. So thank you to everyone who texted in to let us know. And Jeff on the Island says, at times, Drant sounds like Megatron when being rational, and other times, more like Starscream when he was getting excited about his point. Fun sounds on the road. So hopefully we're back to sounding roughly like humans here for the remainder of the show. Again, 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So we mentioned it in passing in the first segment, but of course one part of the Evander Kane discussion is very much, okay, what is the next shoe that's waiting to drop, the next domino to fall for the Vancouver Canucks? We've talked a lot about how they probably only had a couple of cards to play here. They've played one. What are they going to do for that last big swing they have? And the name Marco Rossi, I mean, we've been talking about him for, what, months at this point out of Minnesota, and for good reason. And I made the point on the show yesterday that I really feel like Bill Guerin is kind of living in a bit of a fantasy land here on his valuation, or at least what he's publicly saying about the Marco Rossi situation. And there was an update from your Athletic colleague, Michael Russo, today, who, of course, covers the Minnesota Wild, on the Rossi market. Here's what Russo had to say. Guerin continues to tell teams he is not trading Rossi without a significant center or equivalent winger from a production standpoint as the main return. Several teams have shown interest in Rossi, but in a league where the cap is rising and plenty of teams have added cap space, the playoff contenders interested in him are mostly offering futures. So there's been this very public, oh, well, you know, we don't want to make the team worse. We want to get better. But that's so hard to square with you don't like the player. And so this whole idea that, like, you may as well have stepped up to the podium after the playoffs and said, we don't think Marco Rossi could help us win, because that's what your behavior showed during the playoffs. So if that's the case, why do you expect people to give a higher value player for this, for Marco Rossi? It has never made sense. And I will note, and I don't think it was ever quite the same tone as Bill Guerin is taking. And, you know, the J.J. Paterka situation sounds like it was more about the player wanting out than Buffalo wanting to move on. But what Kevin Adams was saying about Paterka was very similar. Like, oh, we don't want to get worse. You know, we're not interested in making our team worse. And as much as I think Kesselring and Doan's a fair package, I do think they made their team worse, right? Because the logic
They definitely traded. The guy they traded in that deal is the highest probability of being a capital G guy. you know?
Or
maybe a capital D dude.
And they did it because the reality is, if you've got a problem, like a high-profile RFA who's eligible for offer sheets and doesn't want to be there, doesn't want to sign with you, you can't really afford to be that picky about what kind of deal you're getting back. You can't live in this world where it's like, well, we'll just get a better player for him. It's like, no, that's not going to happen. Teams are going to offer something like Utah did or something based around more futures. And so, especially when you factor in the potential offer sheet dynamic with Marco Rossi, and then you're by definition only getting futures, right? If you choose not to match that offer sheet, it just feels to me like this is a position that Bill Guerin is going to have to bend from, is going to have to step back from. Some team is going to call his bluff, and I think the Canucks are really well positioned to be that team and eventually land that player.
Well, what does it tell you if Buffalo viewed, given their desire to be competitive and not rebuild, viewed players with Kesselring and Doan's profiles as more desirable than Marco Rossi?
Yeah.
What does that – I mean, that speaks volumes about the probable trade value that Rossi has. The way that we're seeing size, doggedness, physicality valued on the market, you know, I think is enormously different. And I suppose, you know, it'll – like, not only does it link back into how we'll talk about Vancouver's posture vis-a-vis Rossi, but I also think tells us something about the Kane trade, right? Like, the Canucks aren't the only team that viewed getting bigger and heavier in the top six as absolutely vital. They weren't the only team after Evander Kane specifically to fill that need through the unrestricted free agent market. And if you want to understand who's going to get these big valuations, right, on July 1, you know, sort by weight, right? So we're seeing this moment in the market, and, you know, there's an element to which I think it's sensible to zag a little bit. You know, I'm big on the Marco Rossi train, in part because I don't think it's right to call him SMOL small.
Yep.
He doesn't play that way. He's, you know, might be short of stature, but he's a thick boy. And he scores and wins in the dirty areas of the ice. He's also 23, and he's a 60-point center. And we don't need to complicate this beyond that. Like, sometimes a gift, you know, falls from the heavens, and the worst thing you can do is be like, not for us.
No.
Especially when you're a team like Vancouver in such desperate need of center help. Especially if you've gone out and spent some of your cap space on a Kane-like player, right? So, yeah, I mean, I do think that this is a really unique opportunity. I do think your basic formulation that Bill Guerin has bungled this situation is fair and correct. And that also brings me back to where the Canucks are in a position where they're desperate for a center. Desperate.
Yeah.
And Bill Guerin is desperate for a face-saving solution and ideally some size to add to his forward group. Well, you know who are very tight? Bill Guerin and Patrick Alvin.
Yep.
Jim Rutherford too, but Bill Guerin and Patrick Alvin extremely close from their time in Pittsburgh. This is like an all-in-the-family trade if it were to happen, in which both sides can solve one another's problem. It might require the Canucks giving up a little bit more, but that's in line with how the Canucks do business anyway, right? This is a group that wants, like, the governing philosophy for Jim Rutherford in making trades is, you know, let's make a fair deal. And I'll give you an example of this that's kind of newsy. Like, I don't think the Canucks breathed a sigh of relief the way I did, for example, when the New York Rangers decided to fix their costs and give the Wild the 12th overall pick.
Uh-huh.
I think the Canucks viewed it as we'd price that possibility in,
yeah,
and we feel like we paid a fair amount to take the shot that we took on Marcus Pettersson, and we locked him up early, and man, is the market going to make us look good for doing that over the course of the next week. So we were never worried about what the Rangers decided to do or not do with that pick in the first place. We made our decision. We made a fair deal. We paid a price that included a 10% downside risk that we'd surrender a lottery pick in the event that, you know, this went a certain way. And we were happy with the deal we made. We're not sitting around reacting to changes in circumstance like that. Like, that tells you a lot, I think, about, you know, how this Canucks front office does business, where their priorities are at, the overall idea oft repeated internally that you can sit around in February patting yourself on the back for having not overpaid for X player, but then you don't have X player helping you win games.
Yeah, as you miss the playoffs by 4 points.
Right.
Like, dang.
Yeah, well, or whatever, right? Like, make the moves. And so that's, you know, I'm curious to see sort of exactly where the price falls and exactly how this all goes down. I'm not suggesting that the Canucks are a front runner here, but I do think if you're framing it as, like, what's the next domino, I do think the Rossi one, for a whole host of reasons, where our attention should be focused.
Not that the insiders as a group around the NHL are perfect or flawless, but I generally think, like, if you know which ones to follow and which ones to pay attention to and how to read between the lines, you can get a pretty good idea of the lay of the land. There's always surprises, of course there are, but, like, point me to the team that has been more consistently linked to Marco Rossi than the Vancouver Canucks. Doesn't exist. Point me to the team that I know you've suggested on this program yesterday that, like, they don't view Marco Rossi's size as necessarily a huge strike against him.
No, they don't view him as small, period.
Right. So point me to another team that we can say that about. I don't follow all the teams, of course, as closely as I do the Canucks, but, like, I haven't heard, Montreal's not concerned. You know, I've heard the opposite. I've heard Calgary, Montreal, they're scared off by his size. So, like, at a certain point, I find it very, very difficult to believe that Marco Rossi is back with the Minnesota Wild next year. And until someone points me to a more likely landing spot where the team is desperate for a young top six center, and they are interested in the player, and they don't really care about his size, like, I don't know where we're going to find a more likely landing spot for the player. And until that happens, I'm going to kind of more than half expect him to end up on the Vancouver Canucks, and I really think it's just a question of what that deal ends up looking like. GURP from Surrey said, Drancer, yesterday you mentioned to look out for Bluger or Joshua for guys that might be involved in a trade. Who could those trades be for? I do think there's a strong, like, if a Marco Rossi trade comes to fruition, it would not surprise me at all to see one of those players included. Like, not at all. And that's part of the safe, especially you talk about, like, face-saving measures for Bill Guerin. I look at a player like Dakota Joshua. That is someone where you can pitch this as, we're reshaping our roster for the playoffs.
Right?
Like, yeah, it's a talent. You know, he's not going to be as flashy. He's not going to put up points. But, hey, this is a guy we're really – and I get it. Dakota Joshua is awesome. At his best, he can be a really cool, physical, impactful player for you. So I don't even think that would be BS from Bill Guerin. But again, you think about, like, what he's prioritizing, the messages he's sending with how they utilized Rossi in the playoffs, all of that would not shock me at all to see a package built around 15th overall and Dakota Joshua for Marco Rossi.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, I mean, I think the – so what I was reporting basically was the Canucks are at a point where they have about $7 million in cap flexibility, and if they're going to – continue to upgrade their roster, if they're going to land a piece as significant as a second line center, that's probably going to require a money out aspect to bring the requisite salary in. I mean, the reported ask for Marco Rossi and his agent Ian Pulver is something like, you know, $49 million over 7 years, right? That's 7 times 7. Well, that would be all of the Canucks space, and there's still some work to be done, Atu Ratu to sign and on and on. So, you know, that, like, it's not exactly breaking news that if the Canucks are going to keep hunting for a top player, that they're going to have to find some money out options. And, you know, they are hunting aggressively over the next 36 hours for that center. Make no mistake, that is the organization's top pre-draft priority. And, yeah, I mean, Joshua and Bluger are a pair of, you know, veterans who've done it before. They fit the mold that teams would look at, where they're like, that guy knows how to win, or that guy's physically assertive, or, you know, they're bigger players, they can succeed in heavy moments. Bluger's obviously a penalty killing specialist too, so he's got that you know, in his actually, honestly, both of them are really good killing penalties, to be totally honest with you. I still think Joshua's penalty killing prowess might be too often overlooked by us. I do think that those are real options and guys that I'll be looking for. It's not like the team wants to move them.
No, it's not like they're shopping them to like shake up the roster. It's just
I think it's
either if they help the deal for the center go down in Rossi's case, then okay. Or if you need to clear up additional salary cap space to go
exactly
find that player, then you look for ways to move them.
Yeah, dead on.
I also, just the other thing on the Rossi, and I was kind of describing it from, like, what else is Minnesota going to do to solve their problems? But you could easily flip it around, and what else are the Canucks going to do to solve their problem? Is there a player that checks all the boxes out there on the trade market that, again, is not just like, well, maybe if Jared McCann becomes available? It's like, well, why would Seattle trade him? Why is Seattle desperate to trade him? I don't think it's a coincidence that the significant players that have been dealt so far in the run-up to the draft are all the ones where these teams sending them away, it was like the thorniest situation for the team. You know what I mean? Like Mason Marchment, well, we need to clear salary cap space, so you're gone to Seattle. Trevor Zegras, this relationship has reached the end of its road. We don't really have interest in bringing you back. We got to send you to Philly. Even J.J. Paterka, it's like, we would have liked to keep you around, but you're not interested. We don't want to force it, so, hey, we'll do the trade to Utah. Like, we haven't seen a lot of teams just, like, wake up and be like, hey, you know what? What if we trade our 26-year-old second-line center who's trending well? You know what I mean? Like, there's always something, whether it's cap crunch or the relationship has broken down or whatever it is, that has caused these trades. And, again, that points you back to Rossi. Like, Rossi's the next guy in that line where it's like, yeah, I just don't see him being back with his team, so they're going to have to do something.
Yeah, now, we do sometimes see these situations get sorted out. Cole Perfetti's situation last summer was not too distinct from where we're at with Marco Rossi. So there's ways to put the genie back in the bottle.
I think Russo mentioned Marty Natchez as well, where it was like, this isn't a long-term fit, but let's do the short-term deal and then we'll find the trade.
Right.
So that's a possibility.
Absolutely a possibility, but you know, we know where this ends up, right? If they end up with a bridge deal, it's going to be a bridge to somewhere very specific. and
another city.
Yeah, and realistically, that's not the best case scenario for either side, right? I mean, no one really wants to.
No, well, especially because Rossi is like, well, you guys don't like me, so you're not going to play me. You're not going to like put me in good situations, and then my trade value, like, not my trade value, my contract value is not going to be significant.
Right.
So he, like, there's reason. Yeah, that's a theoretical solution, but there's also reason to be very wary of that. Whereas I don't think the same concern existed with Marty Natchez in Carolina when he signed that bridge deal. Like he was like, oh, you'll still use me, and then I'll just go somewhere else.
For sure, I
don't think the same trust exists for Marco Rossi and in Minnesota.
No, I mean it's embarrassing to get iced the way he was in the playoffs. I mean that's embarrassing. Like,
yep.
And you know, I'm sure he'll feel and quite rightly that his performance didn't warrant it, didn't dictate it. And so, yeah, we'll see exactly where this ends up. But, yeah, I think from a Canucks perspective, what's the next domino? I feel like it is Rossi. I feel like Rossi's the next domino, not just for the Canucks, but for the trade market in general.
Yes.
And so it'll be fascinating to see exactly where it ends up. You know, a lot of what's publicly available in terms of information really does strongly suggest to me that the Canucks would be, I mean, they've checked in on everyone, I promise you that, so there's no one we can talk about and be like, well, the Canucks might be in on that. Like, they're in on everything.
Someone's available?
Yeah.
Give us a call, guys.
They've called. But this one would seem to be a fit that makes an unusual amount of sense, an uncanny level of sense.
And again, if you'd asked me like a week ago to rank like forwards most likely, significant forwards most likely to be dealt over the next week, like Zegras, Paterka, and Marchment probably all would have been in that list, along with Rossi. So I do feel like kind of the league as a whole, we're just checking those names off, and sooner or later here, it's going to be Marco Rossi's turn to get shipped somewhere. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. One other bit of Canucks-adjacent news that I wanted to mention here, and as a reminder, we will hear from Evander Kane speak to the media live at Rogers Arena in about 12 minutes at 1 o'clock. We'll carry that live here on Sportsnet 650. I'm just trying to keep track of all the different reports and rumors out there right now, but I believe it was Darren Dreger who reported that the Dallas Stars, yes, it was, the Dallas Stars, sounds like the Dallas Stars are finalizing their head coaching decision. Glenn Gulitzson and Neil Graham are believed to be favored. So notably no mention of Manny Malhotra there in the kind of finalist position for the Dallas Stars. It's not done, Yeah. But I certainly read those two names being included by Darren Dreger as the favorites to suggest that Manny Malhotra will not be the next head coach of the Dallas Stars, and that would also...
Well, let's let things play out,
we're
going to keep changing our minds on
but
this.
But if we were running a book, though, on this, you know what I mean? Like, if we were taking back...
Oh, the line would have
moved. The line would have shifted massively.
And the Gullitson factor is an interesting one, too, because that's a partial explainer for why this rollout has been slow. There was an external candidate they were looking at, and it's an external candidate who used to be their head coach.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting wrinkle here, but I would let this play out a little bit more. There's been precious little information about this.
Yep.
Very few names have leaked in terms of, like, no one's even wanting to be seen interviewing for this job right now.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's Dallas being really respectful of their internal candidate. Again, if they were sold on their internal candidates, it doesn't make sense that they'd be... we'd be, you know, what, 36 hours out from the draft with no head coach. Like, I can't even remember the last time I saw a team go to the draft without a head coach.
Well, Gullitson...
It's happened a couple times, but that's it.
Gullitson, as you said, is kind of one of the candidates who makes that all make sense. And I think Bowman had the weird answer about it in his end-of-season availability, where he was like, someone asked him, he was like, I'm not going to make that announcement. And it's like, what announcement? Is he the head coach? Like, what are you saying? What announcement is there to make about Glenn Gullitson and the Dallas Stars? So that would probably be where I'd be putting my money. But as you said, we'll see. We'll wait to see if the process does play out. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but if the Dallas Stars job goes to someone other than Manny Malhotra, that's the last open head coaching spot in the NHL right now. Where does the relationship between Manny Malhotra and the Vancouver Canucks go in the short term if he doesn't end up immediately getting a head coaching job in the NHL?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that, and this is something that we dealt with when they first made the final. You know, you make the final as an American League head coach, you're on your way up. And it's not that you're on your way out, right? Like, that's the wrong framing. It's not like, where does this go between the Canucks and Manny Malhotra? Because they'll disrespect him, or I'm not intentionally doing the stir up drama for no reason thing that I'm sure a million of our listeners are about to accuse me of, but he's on his way up because this was such a smash success in his first season, and coaches that have that level of success at the American League level don't stay. They go and earn $1.5 million, $2 million a year as an NHL head coach. You know, just like if, you know, you at your job sold whatever to X big account. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There might be some industry and some interest in your industry, too, in poaching you. And you would take those meetings. And so, yeah, I mean, I would suspect that, you know, if there's no NHL head coaching job for Malhotra this summer, I would, you know, strongly expect that he is back. It would be interesting to see if the Canucks consider extending him. He's surely on an entry-level American League-type contract, given his lack of experience when he first took the job. So a lift or some sort of reward outside of whatever playoff bonuses he had in his deal would be a suitable way to, you know, take care of your guy. And then, you know, you sort of see what come what may, right? I mean, there's all sorts of levers you can pull. There's an assistant coaching job at the NHL level. There's an associate coaching job at the NHL level that's vacant. And, of course, you know, you never want to say never. Like, one thing that, you know, like, AHL coaches often think is, like, well, you know, you're behind a guy. Like, think about it from the perspective of Jeremy Colleton last summer.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'm behind the guy in Vancouver who just won the Jack Adams. He's going to be here for a long time.
Yeah. He was 18 months into his tenure and just won the Jack Adams.
Right. Yeah. And so it's
and
like
the toast of the town.
Yeah. Like, so, you know, or like from Bruce There It Is being yelled at in Pemberton in September to Bruce Boudreau being fired by February. I mean, you know, things change so rapidly in this business that, you know, it's not like he's blocked forever behind Adam Foote. Like, I don't know. I don't know what the future holds for anybody.
No.
And so
the future is always shifting. It's difficult to see.
The future is fundamentally unknowable.
Honestly, that's an important thing to keep in mind in life.
The unknowability of the future.
I think we all deal with We all treat everything with too much certainty. Embrace uncertainty.
You're not wrong.
Embrace uncertainty. I'm getting a little philosophical here. I don't know why.
Yeah, you make me sick.
All right, we will take a break on that note.
You don't make me sick. I appreciate it. I just like, have a take, man. Have a take.
Yeah, my take is radical uncertainty. All right, we'll take a break here. Evander Kane, the newest Canuck, he speaks to the media next, and we will carry it live here on Sportsnet 650.